I said. Chapter 6. Happy Ghost. Great Smoky Mountains National Park is huge. The park spans 500,000 acres and contains the highest elevations along the entire Appalachian Trail. It is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and it is the most visited national park in the United States. For northbound AT hikers, the park is significant because some rules apply here that are quite different from the rest of the trail. For instance, it is the only section which requires thru-hikers to purchase and carry a permit, which costs $20. Many hikers are confused by this process, or offended by the fact that they have to pay, and you can hear them complain for days prior to arrival. Another source of friction is that thru-hikers must spend their nights in the AT shelters, or pitch their tents next to them. Visitors who only plan to stay a night or two must reserve the shelters in advance, but with their permits, thru-hikers can stay at any shelter they choose. Stealth campers, those who pitch a tent or a hammock anywhere other than a designated site, are fined and escorted out of the park. The idea is to minimize human impact. The Smokies are notorious not just for their stunning natural beauty, but for an abundance of wildlife. Bears, boar, deer, and rare birds exist here in a concentration seen in few other places in the United States, let alone on the AT. This is also the reason for the third restriction likely to cause a tantrum. No dogs. Voldemort, Droid, and I had no dogs, we knew where the shelters were, and we already had our permits. So when we arrived at Fontana Dam, our only concern was to find food. Blue Indian's car was waiting for us, and he offered to drive us into Fontana Village, and then back to the park before he went back home to Atlanta to start his new job at the zoo. When we arrived at the lot, we were met by the smell of asphalt sealer and the rumble of diesel engines. Orange cones surrounded Blue Indian's jeep, and the crew was about to pour the first batch of thick black goo. He ran toward them, waving his trekking poles above his head. "Stop! Stop!" Droid yelled after him. "Dude, that shit takes days to dry. Just leave it and keep hiking with us." We watched from a distance. The foreman stopped the crew before the jeep was completely painted into the corner. He and Blue Indian exchanged some words in what appeared to be a friendly tone, and the foreman slapped him on the shoulder and laughed as another man in an orange vest removed the cones. Blue Indian tossed his gear in the back and drove to where we stood. "That was close," he said as we got in. "They put up signs 2 days ago that they were redoing the lot. I told him my car's been here for a week and that there was no way I could have known. Dude said that happens every year and that usually it's dry by the time the person gets back, so they just work around them." We drove to Fontana Village, just a couple miles away, and ate cheeseburgers at a restaurant there. Everyone had beer with their lunch except me. That one at Nantahala had practically knocked me on my ass. I figured I had probably lost 5 to 10 pounds since starting, and constantly having an empty stomach made one beer feel like six. That's okay if the only thing scheduled for the afternoon is a nap, but we faced another challenging climb in the heat that afternoon. In fact, we were going to be traveling uphill for nearly 3 days before reaching Clingman's Dome. The general store had a decent selection of hiker food, but the prices seemed high, and I was glad that I had loaded up back at Nantahala, even if it meant that my pack was overloaded for 2 days. Having eaten my load back down to a more manageable weight, I felt much better about the next 3 days, especially with that burger in my belly. Megan's package from home was waiting behind the counter, and it contained so much food that it took nearly an hour to repackage everything. Most of the food hikers carry needs to be repackaged. Pop-Tarts, for instance, are a very popular breakfast staple on the AT. They are inexpensive, contain hundreds of calories, and are relatively light. It's also okay for them to get smashed. A week's worth of Pop-Tarts, however, come in a cardboard box the size and shape of a brick. Peanuts come in a jar that weighs a quarter of a pound empty. Dried fruit and jerky come in a thick, crinkly bag that never closes properly once opened. The best price per ounce for instant coffee is a plastic tub large enough for 10 people to share, and so on. This is why a big part of the resupply ritual consists of moving things out of boxes and bags and into smaller bags. Megan dumped the contents of her care package onto a picnic table in front of the general store and spread it out, covering the entire surface. "Fuck! What am I supposed to do with all this?" "I hope you guys don't mind," said Droid, changing the subject. "But I'm going to hitch back to the trail and get a head start. I have to be done by September." "Before you go, take some of these brownies," Megan said. "There must be 5 pounds here." Blue Indian and I stayed with her while she repacked, then drove back to Fontana Dam. We thanked him again and hugged him goodbye. "Man," he said, I really wish I was going the whole way with you. Yeah, we said, us too. When he drove away, I asked Megan, how many times have you heard that so far? I've lost count. We double-checked our permits and entered the Smokies. Looking up from Fontana Dam, you can just barely see Shuckstack Fire Tower. Up close, it's 100 feet of steel and wood. From the dam, 3 miles of trail and 2,000 feet of elevation shrink it to a tiny rectangle made of toothpicks. Megan and I walked along the blacktop over the dam and crossed onto a gravel road that led to the trail. Just before we entered the tree line, a large pickup truck pulled to a stop beside us. The tires were huge, and the abundant chrome was coated with a thin layer of dust. The passenger window slid down, revealing a plump woman with white hair and glasses. Her husband leaned toward us from the driver's seat and shouted over the rumble of his engine, "Hey, y'all, is this the Appalachian Trail?" "It is," I said. His wife looked at him, us, and then back to him. "Where's it come out?" she asked. "Depends on which way you're going, I suppose." "That way," I said, pointing north, "goes all the way to Maine." "Woo-wee," he whistled. "Y'all going all the way?" "We sure are," I said, standing just a bit straighter. "Hot dang, I bet that's going to take a couple weeks, isn't it?" Megan spoke up. "Whole lot longer than that, more like 6 months." The man and his wife exchanged looks of amazement. 6 months," he exclaimed. "Y'all must not have kids, then." Megan and I looked at each other, then I laughed. "Oh, we're not... We met just a few days ago," she interrupted. The driver's wife raised a hand to her cheek. "So you're doing this by yourself?" "Yes, ma'am." "Oh, my goodness, you're very brave." They gazed admiringly at Megan. "I'm by myself, too," I pointed out. "So brave," the man said. 6 months, dang. Well, good luck to both of you, and God bless." We thanked them, and they rumbled off, leaving a cloud of dust. At the end of the gravel road, a modest sign welcomed us to the AT portion of the Smokies. We were still in the green tunnel, but things were changing. The trail was steeper, and the ground was choked with greenery. Mayapple and thick carpets of ferns and moss covered every flat surface other than the brown strip of dirt leading us north. Rhododendrons were blooming, tiny purple explosions by the millions. Bright orange flame azaleas and red star-shaped flowers called fire pinks were sprinkled among their mostly white cousins, the trillium. It had rained the previous night, so the orange salamanders were out. I narrowly avoided stepping in a giant pile of shit. "Good Lord," I shouted. "Look at this. I seriously would have lost my shoe in this." "What the fuck shits like that?" wondered Megan. "That's not manure." "Bear." "No way." "Way. Look how black it is," I said. "Are you sure?" she said. "That pile's the size of a soccer ball." "I'm sure. Unfortunately, I do have some experience with bears." We resumed hiking, and I told her about the bear I came face to face with on my shakedown hike at Shining Rock. "That's crazy," she said. "I want to see one." "Don't worry," I assured her. "I'm sure we'll see plenty." We didn't see any bears that day, but we did see 3 wild boars, a female with 2 piglets. Initially, her lumbering black shadow seemed like a bear to us, our expectations playing tricks on our eyes. When the mother saw us, she squealed and bolted, luckily away from us. I hadn't done any research on boars, and I would not have known how to handle an angry one. Now that I've had time to read up on the subject, I understand the approved technique is to already have your will drawn up beforehand. As we walked on, we saw a man ahead carrying the largest backpack I have ever seen. He was obviously struggling, rocking back and forth with every step and wheezing. By the time we reached him, he had removed his pack and was sitting on a rock. He reached into his pocket for a bandana and wiped sweat from his shiny, bald head. Both he and his pack were overweight. He looked utterly miserable. "Excuse me," he called to us. "Excuse me. Hi. How well do you two know this area?" "I've never been here before," I said, "but I do have a map. What are you looking for?" "I think there's supposed to be some kind of a cabin for hikers near here. Do you know anything about it?" "Do you mean the shelter?" Megan asked. "Yeah, the cabin," he said. "Please tell me it's close." "Actually, it's another 3 or 4 miles," I said. He groaned. "I knew this was a bad idea. I just wanted to go backpacking for Memorial Day weekend. It shouldn't be this hard." He had an old external frame pack, the kind you see in grainy photos from the 1960s, full nearly to bursting. Every loop on the outside had something hanging from it, including a hatchet, a full water bottle, and a frying pan. "I borrowed all this stuff, and now I hate every piece of it," he said. His head sank, and he stared at his feet. Megan glanced at me with raised eyebrows. You know it's not actually a cabin, right? It's just a shelter, like a lean-to. It only has three walls. No beds? Not unless you're carrying one, she nudged his pack with her toe. How far are you going? I asked. I was going to have my son pick me up at Interstate 40 on Monday, but I think I'll get to the cabin tonight and then turn around in the morning. Megan was about to correct him again, but I raised a hand to stop her. I-40 was 80 miles away. He'd already decided to turn back, so there was no point in telling him his plan was even more foolish than he realized. Where's your map? I'll show you where the shelter is. I don't have one. Unbelievable. It was an hour or two until dusk, and he was closer to the shelter than his car back at the dam. Forward was his best option. Okay, see that? I said, indicating a white blaze. Yeah, I've seen a bunch of those. What are they? That's what's going to save you. Those white blazes let you know you're on the trail. No point telling him what the AT was. Just keep it simple. Keep walking that way, and you'll be at the shelter in a couple hours. He groaned again. Okay. You'll be fine. Looks like you have plenty of water. Make sure you keep drinking it, okay? Okay. He stopped staring at his feet and looked up. How will I find where to go? If this shelter is anything at all like the other ones, there will be a few people there. You'll hear us. There will probably be a fire. Can't miss it. Just take your time, okay? You'll be fine. We encouraged him to rest a while longer and have something to eat, then went on our way. After we crested the next hill and he was out of sight, Megan exploded. Cabin? Really? I joined in, equally exasperated. How the hell does someone decide that the Smokies is the best place for their first solo backpacking trip? That pack must have weighed 90 pounds. Think he'll really be okay? I think he just learned a hard life lesson, but yeah, he'll live. As the trail continued to challenge us for the next mile, I couldn't help thinking about the large, sweaty man huffing along, taking tiny steps. About halfway up our final climb of the day, I remembered the trick Flat Feet had showed me, the one where you exhale forcefully and flap your lips like a horse whinnying. Oh my God, what was that? Megan called back. I explained to her how the trick helped to push the carbon dioxide from the depths of the lungs, and for the rest of the way up to the shelter we made horsey sounds and cracked each other up. Molly's Ridge Shelter was nothing at all like what we expected. Every shelter since Springer Mountain had been a simple three-walled wooden structure with a raised platform for sleeping, maybe a few wood pegs for hanging coats and packs. This thing looked like it had been designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. Stone walls supported a long metal roof with skylights and a chimney. Holy shit, this thing has a fireplace inside! No wonder that guy thought there was a cabin up here. He probably only saw pictures. Megan disappeared around the corner to claim her spot along the wall, while I stopped under the covered eating area to meet our bunkmates who were cooking there. I told them about the bald guy with the heavy pack. They reminded me that the park was full of rangers. One had just been here, in fact, checking permits. The big guy would be fine. Even if he had to spend the night out there, there had to be something in that gargantuan pack to keep him warm. Hell, he could even just curl up under the pack. We found Forager and Lemmy's names in the logbook, but no cartoon. I showed off my schnozzle bag, possibly my favorite piece of gear. Besides being a waterproof pack liner, keeping my sleeping bag and camp clothes dry, it also works as an air pump for the mattress. You just hold the corners and flap it to scoop up air, pinch it shut, connect the nozzle to the air mattress. Presto! Three times is enough to fill my air mattress for bedtime. Megan whistled. That's pretty high-tech, Green Giant. I have this rolled-up piece of foam. It has some mud on it. Yeah, I had one of those when I was in the Marines. I still can't picture you as a Marine. You're too nice. She sat cross-legged on the floor of the shelter and began piling stuff sacks around her. Thanks, I said. I get that a lot. Even when I was in, I used to get yelled at for saying please and thank you to my troops. I squeezed more air into my mattress and tested it. No, I'm not a badass by any means. I wouldn't last 3 days out here without my gear. She picked a bag seemingly at random and dumped it into her lap. She shrugged at the spilled contents and replaced them into the bag. Oh, me too. I don't even know how to make a fire. Really? What about the one you started with your map? She laughed. That was the only part that burned. Unless asking pretty much any guy to make one counts as starting a fire, then no. That's a pretty cool superpower you have. I know, right? Gets me rides to town and free drinks, too. I peered over my glasses at her. You be careful with that. Oh, totally, she said. That's why I have this. She rooted through one sack and then another before producing a 6-inch throwing knife in a black sheath. How much does that thing weigh? I asked. And what good does it do you when it's buried in some bag? I'm not stupid, she answered. I clip it to my shoulder strap. I only wear it when I'm hitchhiking, duh. And you still get rides, I said. Wait till you see the shorts. Through one open eye, I could tell that it was nearly sunrise. I was trying to go back to sleep when I heard Megan's quick footsteps and hushed voice urging me to join her outside. I stepped barefoot into the dewy grass. Right at the tree line stood a pair of 4-point bucks. One munched the grass while the other stretched his neck to reach a low branch. I mimed taking a picture, but Megan shook her head. Quiet, she whispered. You'll scare them away. We have deer on my parents' prop... The big one charged. I took a step back. Is that thing... Jesus Christ! She shoved me down into the grass and assumed a battle stance. The thing got to within 20 feet of us, then darted right and vanished behind the shelter. What the fuck was that? She asked, reaching out a hand to help me back up. The deer reappeared on the far side of the shelter, where it faced another buck, this one with 2 fuzzy nubs atop his smaller head. Despite his meager rack, the littler one reared up and bolted towards his larger brother, who absorbed the small thump with his shoulder and then bit the newcomer on the ass. The pair then circled around the shelter and rejoined their friend, who was still munching grass. "Sorry I got your camp shorts wet," Megan said. On our way out of camp that morning, we met a ranger and told him about the bald guy with the enormous pack. He said his colleague had already radioed him about meeting the man last night. The guy had turned around and was on his way out, doing fine. The day was full of uphill climbs, and by the end we were at another shelter exactly like the last one. Same stone construction, same covered picnic table, same fireplace, even some of the same people. The only difference was that this one was at a higher altitude. The jagged black line of my map's elevation profile for the days ahead climbed and dropped, but left each page considerably higher than where it started. It was a stockbroker's wet dream. At the top of it would be Klingman's Dome and my family. As we huffed up some beautiful green hill together, I told Megan about my sister-in-law, Priscilla, who had joined Katie and me to hike Klingman's Dome a few years ago. She has a black belt in karate and was doing some kind of fitness modeling at the time. I think the three of us only did 8 miles that day, but we were struggling to keep up with her. She sounds pretty tough, Megan said. Not too long after that, she was in a pretty horrible car accident. She was on a road trip and asleep in the passenger seat when they blew a tire and wrapped the car around a pole. No one thought she'd make it. We packed funeral clothes just in case. Name any bone, she probably broke it. Punctured organs, cracked spine and pelvis. Head the size of a watermelon, she spent 2 weeks in a coma. I needed to pause. Everything was uphill. Fuck, Megan said, her poles clicking behind me. How is she now? About a month ago, she ditched her cane so she could walk into her dojo and bow to her sensei. Now I want to meet her. I hitched my pack and tightened the waist belt. Anyway, since she was with us the last time I was on Klingman's Dome, I can't help but think about her and her struggle, while we struggle, you know? We wound up hiking 18 miles that day, the longest yet for each of us. I had forgotten it was Memorial Day. It was just the day I'd see Katie again, but less than a mile into that morning's walk, we had already met 2 day hikers. By the time the summit was visible, we'd lost count of the people wearing jeans and carrying tiny water bottles. Megan gestured at the observation deck, still a speck from 3 miles out. Good Lord, that thing is ugly! There are many and varying opinions about this structure, which I like to call the concrete monstrosity. It is a large, flat disc with a quarter-mile spiral approach ramp jutting out from what is the first alpine environment a northbound hiker encounters. Rhododendrons and mountain laurel have given way to stunted pines and dead hemlocks. The trail took us over and around moss-covered rocks. Last year's needles were a soft brown carpet that cushioned our soles and muffled every sound. The place smelled like Christmas. "Hey, Voldemort," I said. "Yeah? Remember Blood Mountain?" She grunted. "Oh, God, yes." "What didn't you like about it?" "The way it turned everyone into a whiny little bitch." I laughed. "Okay, I was going to say something along those lines, but yeah, that was, what, like a half a day of uphill? We've been going up for 4 days now." "Highest point on the AT," she crowed. 2 miles from the summit, the monstrosity grew as we approached. I took a gamble and pulled out my phone. Only one bar that came and went, but it was enough to fetch a batch of text messages from my mom, my niece Emily, and Katie. "We're leaving in an hour. We're on our way. We'll be there soon. We're here. Where are you? LOL, where are you?" That was Emily. I smiled and sent my reply. Hike south on the AT and you'll find me. The next mile couldn't pass quickly enough. Yeah, pretty rock, lovely ferns. Shut up, bird, I'm trying to find my wife. And there they were. Katie and Emily bounded down the trail toward us. Uncle Gary, is the whole trail like this? My niece asked. I didn't know what to say. This part was so different from the beginning, but the change had been so incremental to the point I had hardly noticed. I'd crossed 100 big and small mountains already, some with names, most without. I couldn't remember the last time I had seen one of those black and red millipedes, or where the snakes had started. Just some of it was the best I could do. Katie moved in for a hug, then balked and grimaced. Making up her mind, she hugged me anyway. Sorry, I said. No shower since. Megan jumped in. Ooh, I did laundry in a stream 2 nights ago. Well, not in the stream, because you're not supposed to do that, but with stream water. No soap, though. So, Katie said, you must be Voldemort, and held out a hand. Megan countered with a hug, which was awkward because Katie's hands had no hope of meeting on the far side of Megan's pack. Mom down at the car? My mom is in her 60s, and one of her knees is made of titanium. Of course she was at the car. If I remembered correctly, the view from the parking lot was spectacular. Don't worry, Katie said. She's not bored. I hadn't seen my car since Springer Mountain, and I almost didn't see it at Clingman's Dome, because it was surrounded by a mob. Who the hell are those people? I asked. Must be more hikers, Katie said. There were only 4 or 5 when we got your text message. The back hatch to my Honda Element had been turned into a tailgate buffet. I pushed through the crowd to hug my mom. She gagged. Oh my God, Gary, you stink. But you're still my baby, and I love you. Come here. I kissed her cheek and turned to the food in amazement. An aluminum turkey pan full of broccoli and cauliflower, carrots with blue cheese and ranch dressing, 4 homemade pizzas, 2 were gone already, and a large bowl of strawberries, 4 pans of chocolate brownies, and 2 large cans of whipped cream, the spray kind with the red cap. It has everything I've been craving. Exactly. How? A little birdie told me. Katie smiled at Megan. Remember when you had me text Katie? My trail partner asked. We've been besties ever since. I told her you wanted strawberries. Katie shrugged. Surprise? I was delighted. As long as it gets me brownies and strawberries, I'm all for it. And whipped cream, too, yelled someone from the mob, and everyone laughed. A curly-haired guy with a beard and round cheeks picked up a can and gave it a curious look. His friend, with spiky blonde hair, urged him to spray some in his mouth. Curly complied, making a bit of a mess, white foam collecting on the edges of his beard. It's whipped cream, Lemmy, said the spiky-haired guy. Lemmy tilted his head and overdid it, whipped cream blasting over his beard and filling his nostrils. Katie shrieked, Oh my God, you're Lemmy! He coughed and laughed at the same time, propelling whipped cream and whatever else was in his beard all over us. He pointed at his closed mouth and nodded, blinking and blushing. One of the other hikers asked me how we knew Lemmy. We don't, I said. Until now, that is. I've only seen the cartoons in the logbooks. We're your biggest fans, Katie exclaimed. Lemmy wore a serape with yellow, blue, and red stripes, and Columbia embroidered on the left breast. He used it to wipe his hands and mouth. I can die now, he said, his voice unmistakably foreign. I can die happy. I have this, whipped cream, and I have fans. He chuckled, his shoulders heaving. And 2 of them are girls, he added blushingly, followed by more shrug chuckling. The girls especially seemed to like this, and when they giggled, he blushed more. When I die, I will be a happy ghost. Someone crunched a carrot and pointed at Lemmy Serape. You told me you were from France. Oh, that was before Colombia. I only visited there. While the 2 of them straightened this out, the hiker who had asked me whether I knew Lemmy told me that he was actually from Israel. Megan asked my mom what she thought about my AT hike. Mom flicked a hand dismissively. Doesn't surprise me a bit. All he and his friends ever did growing up was walk around the neighborhood at night. Not getting into trouble or anything, just walking. Each tray or bowl reached the point where no one wanted to take the last serving, and most of the crowd thinned out. There were still tourists everywhere, but most of the hikers were moving on. From the dome, it was either 10 miles to the next shelter or hitch into Gatlinburg. We invited Lemmy to hike with us, and he agreed. Ah, shit, I said, suddenly realizing a hitch in the new plan. I was going to suggest Katie take us to Gatlinburg for resupply, but there's no way we'll all fit in here. You're not going to Gatlinburg, Katie declared. Why not? I asked. Why would you go there when home is just a short drive away? She moved closer. Of course, you'll need to shower first. Twice. What about Mom and Emily? I whispered. They rented a cabin a mile down the road.
Oh,
yes, excellent idea, I said. I can do laundry. We'll have breakfast in the morning. Yes, I agree. Megan said not to worry about her and Lemmy. They'd hitch to Gatlinburg and then back to the trail in the morning. With so much holiday traffic, it would be easy. We would all meet up the trail the following night. If that actually happens, it'll be the first time, I said skeptically. Go on, Megan insisted. We'll catch you. Go have fun. We didn't say goodbye because you're not supposed to do that, so I said happy trails and then climbed into the car with the girls and the food. As we turned out of the parking lot, Emily opened her window and whispered to my mom, Grandma, Uncle Gary smells like pee. Chapter 7. Pantry. So many nights on the trail, I missed Katie. I missed our warm, soft bed. Now that I was in it, I spent the night kicking and squirming. The quilt was too heavy, and some naked person kept touching me. I kept thinking the sun was rising, only to turn and see floating green numbers by the bed. I'd gotten accustomed to sleeping in a room this size, only minus an entire wall. That's where the wind and the crickets were supposed to be. Their absence was like an itch. I wasn't supposed to be here. "Do you toss and turn like that on the trail?" Katie asked me at breakfast. "Not even close," I said. "As soon as it gets dark, I'm out, and I don't remember a thing until I hear the birds." "No dreams?" "Almost never." I sipped my coffee. "This is so good." We sat quietly for a minute, just looking at each other. I was in the place I dreamed about, and all I could focus on was the unnatural hum of the refrigerator. "We should get going." While I packed, I talked. "You know how everyone on the internet and all the books say, 'It's the people,' over and over again? I kind of get it now." Katie handed me a clean shirt. "Go on." "I mean, I knew it wasn't going to be complete wilderness, but I haven't camped alone more than a couple times. I'm already losing track of how many people I've met, and most of them have been pretty cool. Thing is, after a couple days, they all either drop out or pull ahead. I heard Big Ups is already in Hot Springs." "Really? How do you know?" "Hiker Grapevine. A section hiker coming south passed him going the other way a couple days ago. He asked the guy to tell us he said hi." "Aw, Big Ups is so nice." "So was that sectioner. He told us he had about 12 other hellos to deliver. Had to start writing them all down."
"Don't people use the logbooks for that?"
"Yes, and every other means available, too. I've seen notes impaled on tree branches or left under a rock right on the trail. I saw where someone wanted their friends to know he took a side trail, so he made his initials out of rocks and an arrow out of sticks to point the way. People are pretty creative out there. It's almost like we have a sixth sense about where everyone is."
"Do you and Megan pass notes?" she teased.
"Yeah, because we're boyfriend and girlfriend," I replied. "I know you know, but it's funny how many people have assumed that. No, we don't pass notes. We don't have to. I think this is the first time we've been more than 10 feet apart since we met." She raised an eyebrow. "Okay, I'm exaggerating, but only a little. We were going up something called Jacob's Ladder the other day, this fucking relentless monster of a steep climb. There were a couple places where I could reach out and touch the trail in front of me, it was so steep. We were pulling ourselves up by roots and branches. Sweat was pouring down my face. I was huffing and puffing the whole way, and there she was, right on my heels the whole time, almost step for step. Wow, that's pretty impressive for a guy your age." Katie looked me up and down. "You're as fit as a 22-year-old girl." "And you know what she was doing the whole time? Talking. Talking about nothing. Non-stop. I asked her if she wanted to pass me, you know, if I was holding her up, and she said no. Went right back to whatever it was. I can't shake her."
"Are you trying to?"
I thought about it.
"Not really, I guess. She's entertaining, at least.
I forget where we were, but we had to stop once so she could do a handstand up against the tree she really liked."
"So they don't all drop out or pull ahead?"
"I guess not. She actually listens to my advice, too, which is nice. Did you know this is her first backpacking trip longer than an overnight?"
"I think you mentioned that."
"I think she'll be good on her own by the time I flip."
"I think she was good on her own before you came along."
"I know, but just barely." I closed the top of my pack and looked at the door. I was so happy to be there, but I needed to feel the sun and the wind. There were too many walls. Katie snapped me out of it.
"Speaking of flipping, I did some math. I calculated your average daily miles, and if you keep your current pace, you'll be in New Jersey in August."
Shit, that's what I came up with, too.
As much as I loved the idea of being whisked up to Maine in August, I wasn't thrilled with the idea of then walking south through what I'd heard was the most dramatic and breathtaking part of the trail, only to finish at some random bridge or deli in New Jersey. The sign atop Mount Katahdin is sometimes referred to as the sandwich board. Perhaps I could get my photo taken standing on the one outside Tony's Subs or wherever the hell I'd be. We discussed her picking me up sooner, possibly Harper's Ferry, and decided to leave a decision on where to flip until later. My sixth sense was telling me that Megan and Lemmy were probably trying to hitch back to the trail from Gatlinburg, and that if we left now, it would increase my odds of actually seeing them again. Along the way, we picked up my mom and niece and stopped at a grocery store so I could get enough food to carry me the next few days. The drive back to Clingman's Dome was dizzying. The road launched us over some of the highest peaks in the Smokies. I was getting the same views I was accustomed to on a daily basis, but delivered at a speed which was impossible to process. Sleeping in my own bed, zooming along in a car, the blinking lights and beeping registers at the store, it was all too much. I needed the green tunnel. I closed my eyes until we were there. I stepped into a parking lot full of cars, but this time there were no hikers. The ones who had camped nearby had already passed through, and the ones coming back from town wouldn't be here for a while. No Voldemort, no Lemmy. The AT picked up near the base of the concrete monstrosity, a quarter-mile hike from the car. I hugged and kissed everyone after posing for more pictures and stepped into the crowd of weekenders clamoring their way onto the big spiraling ramp. I continued past it and dropped over the edge as fast as I could, down into the cover of pines which muffled the din coming from the dome. Stopping at a rock to put my foot up and rub my shin, I thought, when did this start to hurt? So far, I hadn't needed a single pain reliever of any kind. It was best not to mask this new pain, I decided. It was only a minor ache, and if it got worse, I'd like to know. Strong as a 22-year-old girl, that green giant. As I walked alone, the small ups and downs delivered balcony views of the same vast green arenas I had seen on that morning's drive, only now at the correct speed. When the trail went up, I was surrounded by a carpet of soft brown needles, green spruce, and black balsams. Rocks leaned like crooked teeth. When the trail went down, I was surrounded by a canopy of wide green leaves and softwoods like poplar and beech. The low beech forests were protected by barbed wire fences, surmounted by metal ramps full of holes designed to prevent crossing by hoofed animals, particularly an invasive species of wild hog. The portion of the AT that goes through the northern half of the Smokies straddles the border between North Carolina and Tennessee. Most hikers, myself included, are as excited to make that third state line as they were to make the first. Less than an hour later, you're back in North Carolina. Not quite as exciting the third or fourth time. For those few days of hiking, most people stop paying attention. There is one exception, and that is the parking lot at a place called Newfound Gap on US 441. With the same spectacular views as Clingman's Dome, minus the crowds. There are bathrooms, and a sign in the middle of a parking lot shows North Carolina on one side and Tennessee on the other. A guy on a Harley kindly agreed to take a picture of me on each side. Beyond the lot, the trail was narrow and climbed gradually, so I didn't have to exert much. I didn't encounter any other thru-hikers the rest of the day. When I arrived at Icewater Spring Shelter, I figured I had the place to myself. The shelter wasn't far from the trail, just a few steps. It occupied a small corner of an acre or so of clearing, a grassy peninsula with 180-degree views of green peaks skirted by shadowy folds receding to the horizon. Gray clouds filled the sky. I heard the click of trekking poles approaching from the south. How strange, I thought. I already know who it is. I recognized the cadence. Green Giant! The voice was unmistakable. Voldemort! How was Gatlinburg? She threw her pack onto the floor of the shelter. Ugh, I've never been so glad to leave a place in as long as I can remember. Gatlinburg is a shining beacon of commercialism in the middle of a vast wilderness. The town's official nickname is the Gateway to the Great Smoky Mountains, which is appropriate because the border between the forest and the city is as sharply defined as a gate. The road into town winds through trees, rocks, and waterfalls. There is a small sign marking the city limits, and 10 feet later you are bombarded by flashing neon lights, expensive parking, and animatronic bears playing harmonicas and trying to sell you beef jerky and imitation moonshine. The speed limit through town is 20 miles per hour, but it's rare that any car has enough room to accelerate to even half that speed. Every crosswalk is packed with waddling tourists overloaded with bags or pushing strollers. If you need a shirt or coffee mug that says, "Paddle faster, I hear banjo music," you can buy one next door to the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum. "I know," I said. "I've been there. I'm much happier with where I spent the night." It was weird, though. Being in my own house felt like cheating, even though it was less than 24 hours. I watched Megan pull the drawstring at the top of her pack, then flip it over, spilling the contents into a pile on the shelter floor. "Hey, where's Lemmy?" I asked. She looked up from the pile and snorted. "He's still in Gatlinburg. When I left this morning, he was still in his underwear. I think he might be the most disorganized person I've ever met." She held one of her stuff sacks to an ear, shook it, frowned, and then tossed it back into the pile. "What did he think of the place?" "Oh, he loved it. Like a kid at Disney World." "Did you hear he's not from Colombia?" I asked her. "He's from Israel." She opened another small pack and felt through its contents. "So what?" "Exactly. He seems like a cool guy. Who cares where he's from, right? Unfortunately, not everyone feels that way." She raised an eyebrow. "A few years ago, Katie and I went to Peru." "Oh, how cool. That's awesome. Did you see llamas?" "We did. But listen, we were part of a tour group, and there were people in it from all over. Australia, South Africa, Spain. It was a pretty diverse bunch. So, anyway, when they met us, almost every one of them said they were so relieved to meet us. Not because we were Americans, but specifically because we weren't Israelis." "They really said that?" "Yeah. We prodded a little, and they just said more stereotypical crap, like how they're all loud, or how they're all selfish and annoying, and so on. We changed the subject, and it never came up again. I've traveled a lot since, and I haven't seen that specific prejudice often, but it is out there." "Well, he's got to know by now that hikers aren't like that, right?" "You would think so, but then again, he's been on the other side of it for 20-plus years. If he wants to tell strangers he's from France, I say let him." "Well, either way, he loves Gatlinburg," she said. She shook another bag by her ear. This one rattled, and she smiled. "What are you looking for?" I asked. "Something for your ankle. You've been rubbing your shin this whole time, and your ankle is swollen, too." I hadn't noticed. She told me to remove my sock, and I did. "Look how purple it is. Did you roll it or bang it on something?" "I don't know," I said. "It just started to ache today, coming down Klingman's Dome, and I would remember rolling it." "Rub this cream on it. It's a prescription strength, so don't get caught with it. Hopefully it'll help." While I rubbed the cream onto my shin, Megan sat beside me. She took off her shoes, crossed a foot over her knee, and drew her knife, using it to pick dirt from under her toenails. She caught me staring, sniffed an armpit, and said, "What?" "Nothing," I said. "It's just, look at us. How is this acceptable? If we were at a bus stop, I would have run away from you." "Yeah, well, I would have pepper sprayed you first." Sunset was hidden behind a stack of dark clouds. We were asleep in the shelter when I heard something large crashing through the bushes behind us. The disturbance quickly revealed itself to be human. What I thought might be hooves was actually the pounding of two heavy wooden walking sticks. Between them, a single white headlamp blazed. "Is that Green Giant?" the headlamp asked. "And Megan?" She poked her head out of her sleeping bag. "Yes, Lemmy, it's us. I am so glad to find you," he said. I closed my eyes and again fell asleep to the sounds of Lemmy unpacking, Lemmy boiling water, Lemmy eating, and finally the soft scribble and swish of pencils on paper. At some point that night it started to rain, and when we awoke, Lemmy's tent was pitched. His rainfly was loose and flapping in the breeze. When Lemmy finally stuck his head out of his tent, Megan and I were nearly finished eating breakfast. He squeezed his eyes shut and then opened them wide. He stared at us through long, thick lashes. "Is that coffee?" he smiled. I swallowed the last of it. "Yep, and it was delicious. Would you like some?" He thought a moment and asked, "Is it instant?" "Do you think I packed a French press out here? Of course it's instant. Do you want some? I have extra hot wa- No, I don't like it." He stood from his tent, let the flap fall behind him, and walked to his pack. "I have one," he said. "One what?" I asked. "French press. Do you want some?" I couldn't tell if he had mastered deadpan sarcasm in his second language. "No thanks, I'm good." The logbook was on the table in front of us, and I opened it to make an entry before we left. Lemmy watched me turn the pages, and when I reached the one full of bears, he spoke up. "It's not done yet." "It's still very good," I said. He had real talent. Two of the three bears were done in bold lines. The third was just barely a ghost, with short, light strokes that gave him a thin, feathered appearance. The trio was gathered outside a shelter, trying to work out the food-on-pulleys problem. There was no color yet, and even though the faces were depicted by only a few quick lines, their expressions were already clear. The first one was frustrated, the second one was the hungriest, and the third might be clever enough to pull it off. "Is this episode 3?" He sat next to me. "It will be. I am telling a story in all of the books, so that if you walk to Katahdin behind me, you can read the whole thing." Megan stood. "That's really cool, Lemmy. How does it end?" He unfolded a leather pouch, revealing a full set of colored pencils. "I don't know. We will have to find out." He was still coloring when we left, and promised to meet us at the next shelter. Along the way, Megan and I came to a fork in the trail. The AT continued to our right, while the left fork followed a blue-blazed trail to something the sign called Charlie's Bunion. Some previous hiker had written on the sign in black marker, "Do this." Another had circled it, added an arrow, and written, "Totally worth it." Megan took off her pack. "What are you doing?" I asked. "I'm leaving my stuff here. If we're coming right back, why would I carry my whole pack both ways?" "Why are you coming back here? The guidebook says that this side trail parallels the AT and then rejoins it in 2/10 of a mile. As soon as I said the words, I knew her reason. "I can't," I said it with her, "skip any white blazes." "Right, I remember." I put the guidebook back in my pocket. "Well, I've been impure since I skipped those 8/10 of a mile back at the fire tower, so I'll see you up there where they rejoin." I took the left fork and heard her follow. "I'll bring my stuff with me just in case. I probably shouldn't leave it." Charlie's Bunion lived up to the hype scrawled on the sign. The side trail was mostly level, carved into the side of an ever-steepening rock wall. At the final bend, we found ourselves on a boulder pile at the top of a dizzying cliff. The neighboring peaks looked close enough to lean out and touch. The narrow gaps between concealed 1,000-foot drops beneath low, moving clouds. As I stepped closer to the nearest deadly drop, my new perspective revealed a large, flat ledge, only 5 feet below. "Well, that's it for me. It'll never get any better than this." Without looking back, I stepped over the edge. Megan yelled, "What the fuck?" When she saw me crouched safely below, we both laughed. "That looked really cool," she said. "Get a picture of me pretending to hang from the cliff." We spent the next hour climbing and posing, eating and laughing. She handed me my camera, and while we snacked, I scrolled through the pictures. She caught me at a weird angle on this one, I thought. There's no way I'm that thin. My clothes hung from me. Must be the wind, I thought. The next one was the same, and the one after that. I snapped out of my fit of self-absorption when a day hiker coming from the north joined us. I asked him, "How far until this joins back to the AT?" I pointed the way he'd come. "Less than 2 minutes," he said. I asked Megan, "Do you want me to wait for you here while you circle back, or should I just meet you and Lemmy at the next shelter?" It would take at least 10 minutes to get back to the sign, and then probably about the same to get back. She frowned. "It seems silly now that I'm here." "It seemed silly before you were here." "And I'm still moving north, on foot." "Right." "Ugh, I can practically see it from here. Let's just go." She lifted her pack. "Are you sure?" I said. "Hike your own hike and all that." "I'm sure. Just don't tell anyone, okay?" "Sure," I said. "I won't tell a soul." Lemmy kept his promise and caught up with us. Each night, Megan would take the spot on the floor closest to the wall, and I would position myself as a barrier between her and any potential creeps or weirdos. Each night, Lemmy arrived in the dark and pitched his tent just outside the open end of the shelter. At breakfast, I said to him, "Lemmy, you know, if you just stayed inside the shelters with us..." Megan interrupted. "Like you're supposed to." "If you stayed in the shelters with us, you'd be ready a lot quicker in the mornings, and then we could actually hang out for more than just 5 minutes each day." "I don't feel too good in them," he said. "It's too open. I feel like the wolves will get me." "Wolves," Megan said, emphasizing the V, "and there aren't any." "Then whatever makes that sound every night?" "Those are owls, Lemmy," I said. His mouth formed an O. "Besides, tonight you don't have any choice." "Why not?" "It says here in the guidebook that Davenport Gap Shelter has no tent sites." "I will find one. I will make one." "There aren't any cables to hang our food on either. The open end of the shelter has a chain-link fence instead of a wall. The humans and the food all stay inside, and we latch the gate." "I don't want to sleep in a cage." "Think of it as a gated community," I said. I think of it like the movie Jaws, but with a bear. Well then, you'll have material for your next comic. The trail since Klingman's Dome had kept us between 5,000 and 6,000 feet, with only a few relatively small climbs and descents. Exiting the Smokies would take us back down to land lower than we'd seen since Fontana Dam. Over the next 14 miles of hiking, we'd given back nearly an entire mile of elevation. It's easy to assume that hiking down a mountain is more forgiving than hauling yourself and your gear up a mountain. The truth is, both activities can be equally strenuous, for different reasons. Hiking downhill, especially a steep downhill, is often more difficult. With every step, you must exert effort to arrest your ever-increasing forward momentum. Your body, your pack, and gravity are all conspiring to pull you down faster than you intend, and if you relax for more than a few seconds, you'll find yourself running, struggling to keep your bottom half moving as fast as your top half. Failure to do so will send you sprawling. The effort from constantly braking aggravated the mysterious new ache in my shin, and consequently my friends finished their day about an hour ahead of me. When I arrived, I could hear them in the shelter, talking and laughing with someone. It was starting to become easy to identify thru-hikers, the male ones at least. Just look for 3 to 4 weeks of stubble and a bad haircut. Nightwalker had the belly of someone just starting his hike, but the calf muscles and beard of someone who's been on the trail for years. I studied the chain-link fence, and Nightwalker stood to show me how to work the locking mechanism. "I've already met Voldemort and Lemmy, so you must be Green Giant." Lemmy's voice came from inside. "Hey, buddy!" "Hey there," I shut the gate behind me. "Good thing nothing was chasing me," Lemmy smiled and asked for the logbook. Nightwalker handed me a GPS the size of a shoe. "Check that out." "Good lord, this thing must weigh 2 pounds," I handed it back. "You do know about the white blazes, right?" He pressed a button, lighting a number-filled screen. "This puppy's accurate to within a millimeter, beyond military grade. I'm verifying data for next year's edition of the guidebook." I touched my pocket. "This guidebook?" "The same." "Oh, well then, I apologize for almost calling that thing a useless brick." A hiker is actually moving in three dimensions. We're all very aware of the up and down dimension, that's the one that we really feel, so much that often we forget about the other two, east-west and north-south. The good thing about the AT is that you can ignore those dimensions because they don't matter. Once you leave Springer Mountain, you just follow the blazes until you get to Maine. If you accidentally go backwards, you'll run into someone soon enough. The guidebook caters to the thru-hiker spirit of minimalism. Other than street maps of nearby towns, there is no top-down view of the AT anywhere in the book. Each page contains a profile of the next 20 or so miles. One thick black line inches its way across the page. As it goes up or down, so do you. Everything since Klingman's Dome, for example, had been a little wiggle near the top of the page. Today's page started at the top left and then took a hard dive right. Sitting here in the unlit shelter, I squinted at one of the guys who helped draw that line. He told us there were a bunch of people up and down the trail doing this, and that his part was only a couple hundred miles. "After that, I'll go up a little further north and then flip-flop. Not sure when. We'll see where I am and how the weather is." "That's a good plan," I said. "I'm kind of doing the same thing." He asked me when I started, and I told him May 10. He performed some quick math. "Why would you flip-flop?" he asked. "You're on pretty good pace to get to Maine before they close Baxter State Park for snow." Megan agreed. "I said so. I tried to tell him." It was true. She had. I had already disrupted my home routine simply by being here. I cringed at the thought of asking Katie to rearrange things yet again. I'll have to think about it. Nightwalker sat next to Lemmy. "So, no trail name yet?" Lemmy closed the logbook. "I used to have one back at the start. Someone called me Taj Mahal because my tent was a palace." "What tent did you have?" Lemmy blushed and turned his attention to his pencils. He put them away and looked at us. "Before I did this, the only thing I know about camping in the woods is from TV and movies. So when I went to buy my things for this, the guy at the store, he knows I am wounded prey. He sinks his teeth into me." Lemmy tucked his chin and deepened his voice. "You need the biggest tent and the biggest pack, and we can fill it up for you," he continued as himself. "He sold me a tent that I could stand up in. It was like this shelter. So someone named me that." "But no one calls you that now?" "No, I have a better one, but they tell me you are not allowed to make your own." "What if you could?" I asked. "Would it be Happy Ghost?" No. He stood, puffed his chest, and spread his hands, framing an invisible marquee. The legend. Megan said, Lemmy just seems, I don't know, to fit, and dumped her pack. So many nights on the trail I missed Katie. I missed our warm, soft bed. Now that I was in it, I spent the night kicking and squirming. The quilt was too heavy, and some hairy person kept touching me. When did Katie start wearing a bulky watch, I thought, and why do her knuckles smell like oranges? I carefully lifted Lemmy's hand, which was pawing at my face. Now I see why we keep you in your tent, I thought. The sun was almost up, things were starting to chirp, and I had to pee. No point trying to go back to sleep, so I wiggled out of my bag as quietly as I could and stopped at the chain-link fence. My attempt to lift the latch without disturbing the wires was bomb-squad worthy, but I still rattled the cage. Everyone stirred. Sorry, guys. I pushed the door, and the hinge squealed, briefly interrupting the stirring songbirds. Nightwalker's head appeared from his bag. I just stuck my wiener through one of the holes when I had to go at 3 o'clock. Megan mumbled, I wish I had a penis. Nightwalker nodded toward Lemmy. If this other fellow would get up and leave, too, that could be arranged. You know she has a knife, Lemmy said. You might not get your penis back. He cracked himself up, and his shoulders bounced with each laugh. Based on their tone and some of the horrible things we'd all said to each other after the whiskey came out last night, I wasn't worried. I shuffled off to the privy, and when I returned, everyone was eating or packing. I opened the logbook to the most recent page, where I found a lanky hiker wearing a feathered cap. He was punching and kicking at the fence, keeping him out of the shelter. He was squinting, teary-eyed, and exclamation points flying from his head. In the second panel, the exclamation points had turned to blood. A fanged teddy bear with black, sleepy eyes now wore the feathered hat as it licked red chunks from its claws. Three terrified hikers huddled in a corner safe behind the fence. The sign above the fence was blank. I touched the sign. What goes here, Lemmy? Ah, that is why I need you. What is the word that means a closet where you keep food? Megan's hand shot up. I know. Pantry. Ah, yes. This is it. He filled in the missing word and added some shading to the sign. I leaned over his shoulder. You forgot one more detail, Lemmy. This bear that mauled me at the shelter, you forgot to draw his watch. Chapter 8. Disco. We were heading north out of the Smokies, down to the Pigeon River and under I-40. Nightwalker had a shorter day planned than we did. He was stopping at Standing Bear Farm, a hiker hostel where the three of us would just resupply and move on. He was still getting up as we left, so I wished him happy trails, figuring we wouldn't see him again. Megan passed me without stopping as I was filtering water. I'll take web duty, she said. Each day someone has to be the first person to walk on the trail. That person, like it or not, is responsible for clearing the fresh spider webs that formed overnight. The big ones are easy. Heavy with dew, they sparkle in the sun. Usually you can duck under them, but sometimes they need to be swatted down with a trekking pole. The lone strands, or works in progress, are too new to collect dew, so they hang unseen right at lip level. I learned pretty early to lean my head forward and let the brim of my hat do all the work. Sometimes I would catch an inchworm, let it swing while I walked, and then touch a bush with my hat, transporting him to safety. What's the hurry? That's usually my job. I think Forager might have stayed at the hostel last night. They might still be there. She'd mentioned that name before. He was in the books a few times while I was chasing Lemmy. Part of your original crew you met back at the start, right? You got it. Cut off from the routine of our former daily lives, and with no radio, internet, or TV, keeping track of where everyone was became a real pastime. All you had to do was look in the shelter's logs and read backwards. The further back you went in the book, the further ahead, in miles, the people were. I had my own list of logbook celebrities I was stalking. There was no way I'd catch them. These people were weeks ahead. Someone named Engineer, for instance, was making highly detailed sketches depicting his version of trail life rendered in blue or black ballpoint pen. Someone else named Color Bandit was a few days behind him, filling in Engineer's drawings. A whole crew traveled under the name Shrimp Gang. They each had their own wildly colorful trail names, but rarely used them, sticking to their gang name. Once somebody was behind us, their location was anyone's guess. Our only hope of word from behind would be if a faster hiker passed them and caught up to us. Now that I thought of it, though, no one had caught or passed us. Maybe there wasn't anyone behind us at all. Maybe we were last. Less than a mile past the river, the trail crossed a gravel road. It wasn't obvious from the road where the trail resumed, but the guidebook said left, so I turned left. The forest thinned, and I could see a few tents pitched in a clearing ahead. A small stream followed the road to my right. A few of the trees along the water held well-constructed, brightly painted tree houses. Cozy cottages, complete with doors and curtains, had been hoisted into the branches. A group of chickens had gathered in the shade below, scratching at the dirt, and occasionally each other. I crossed a footbridge and approached the bunkhouse, a long single room with a door at each end. The room was unlit, and from the porch I could make out a dozen or so beds and several vaguely human shadows. Unsure whether I'd been noticed, I announced my presence. "This must be the right place," I said. One of the shadows lurched toward me, pushed past, and vomited into the bushes. A second later, her friend arrived to hold her hair. I stepped back as a third shadow exited, moving with less urgency and not headed for the bushes. Black curls hung to his shoulders, and a blue tie-dyed shirt covered all but the very bottom of his hairy belly. The girl in the bushes retched and burped. He held out a closed fist and said, "Bad dinner." I looked at the girl, then back to him. "What was it?" He laughed. "No, I'm bad dinner." The fist was for me. I bumped it with my own. Never shake hands. That's how norovirus gets spread. I was pretty sure that the microbes responsible were capable of surviving on knuckles as well, but I kept quiet. It is often fruitless to dispute hiker-based medical advice. I introduced myself and asked if the girl would be all right. "Eventually. It's just noro. People freak out like it's the plague, but she'll just have the shits for a few days and then wake up fine." Well, there was no room in my schedule for even a single day of the shits, so I kept a tiny squeeze bottle of hand sanitizer in an outside pouch and applied some. "So, do you work here?" He laughed and flipped his hair. "Nah, man, I took a zero here yesterday. Just now getting packed." Taking a zero means staying put, walking 0 miles. Zero can be a noun, a verb, or an adjective. You can zero somewhere, take a zero, or have a zero day. There are also variations, for example, the Nero, which means only hiking a few miles into or out of a town or hostel. Bad Dinner asked me if I was stopping here, and I told him I was just resupplying and would continue to Hot Springs for my first official zero. He seemed impressed. "Your first? Damn, dude, that's hardcore. I think I've had 6 or 7 already. Hell, I'm not even sure how long I've been here. Hey, Rocket, how long have I been here?" "I don't know. Who the hell are you?" Rocket wore camouflage pants cut off at the knees and a gray tank top. His dirty blonde beard matched the frizz that hung past his shoulders. He held a bundle of wood in one hand and a bottle in the other. "Rocket runs the place," Bad Dinner said. "He'll take care of you." Rocket dropped the wood beside a stone fire ring and held out the bottle. He raised his chin and clarified the offer with a grunt. "I like to wait until noon, thanks," I said. He took a swig for each of us and wiped his mouth on his arm. "Come on, I'll show you." The kitchen was in a shed behind the bunkhouse. The space was small and tight. Stacks of mismatched plates and cups filled the shelves. A cardboard sign with handwritten warnings was taped to what appeared to be one of the earliest microwave ovens. Rocket pointed, "The water from the sink's real good." The laundry was outside and behind the kitchen. It was a porcelain tub and a washboard. The resupply shed had envelopes hanging by the door where you could write anything you took and leave cash in the envelope provided.
"There's some frozen pizzas in the shed, too. You can cook them in the kitchen. Close the door when you go in because the chickens will try to follow you and they like to shit all over creation."
I thanked Rocket and he wandered off, and I headed for the resupply shed. Megan was inside. Her pack was leaned against the wall by the door. As I pulled the handle, she shouted, "Stay out!" "Why?" I yelled back, shutting the door. "Oh, sorry, I thought you were a chicken. Come in." The interior was stifling, at least 15 degrees warmer. A dim fluorescent bulb hummed overhead, and warm sunlight leaked in through small windows behind full shelves. Row upon row of Pop-Tarts, Snickers, jerky, granola, raisins, chapstick, rope, and Band-Aids surrounded us. Jars of peanut butter, no more than any two the same size or brand, were piled into a box with a handwritten sign indicating the price. Some shelves had hats and gloves, and there were 3 pairs of mittens next to 1 left shoe. Megan sat in the corner with her piles of food. "Find everything okay?" I asked.
"I think so. How many days do you think it will take to get to Hot Springs from here?"
"Well, it's 30 or 35 miles, so..." I paused to calculate. "The rest of today, plus 1 more full day, plus another half day? We should get there around noon day after tomorrow, so we'll need 2, maybe 2.5 days worth of supplies tops." "Not bad, actually." She stared past me. "Yeah, I should get 5.
"Wait, what? Why?"
"Well, every time I've done resupply so far, I've eaten almost everything within the first day or two, especially these."
She held up two boxes of Little Debbie oatmeal cream pies.
Oh my God, I can't stop eating these. Do you think they'll care if I start eating before I pay?
I pointed to a box, which read, Pay for food here. I don't think their accounting system is very strict. Do you mind if I open this door? It's getting crazy hot in here. I opened the door, kicked a chicken, and shut the door. Never mind. I picked up an envelope and took a crayon from the cup provided.